I'm glad everybody's in such fine spirits this afternoon, renewing old friendships and everything. It's great. So I am opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee on Thursday, March 30th. Yeah. Oh,
get a picture. Get a picture.
Ruining my
Where's Chip Shields when you need him? You gotta throw Chip in there, too.
You will be my friend.
His primary opponent just got a shot of that.
Hey. Members, we have four public hearings on today's agenda. Don't let me interrupt the love fest down there. The first three bills should go relatively quickly and take about half our meeting time. And then for the second half, we have a treat. We're going to have out-of-town Council of State Governments testifier here to talk to us about Rep. Wisnett's task force bill and the topic of workforce development for people with disabilities. So super important subject, and that'll be on the second half. So our first bill up today will be Rep. Hack's bill on associate degrees and apprenticeship credit. And so I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3335. Laura, could you please provide us with a brief summary?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3335 would require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop a plan for enabling community colleges to offer an associate's degree completed in coordination with credits earned in a registered apprenticeship or training program. It requires the HEC to submit a report containing the plan and proposed legislation. There is a -1 amendment, which adds a requirement that the HEC report shall also include the number of additional associate's degrees expected to be earned under the program during each biennium.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon, now I got myself flustered, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, State Representative for House District 19. And yes, I do have the pleasure of bringing before you House Bill 3335 and the -1 amendment. And Representative Holvey here is also going to be co-chief sponsoring that bill with me. And I'm pleased to have him by my side today. This actually came to me by way of a lot of our folks in the trades. They work in apprenticeship programs, and during the downturn of the recession, they oftentimes did not have employment and went out into the workforce looking for jobs and had their certificate, which obviously means everything in their trade, but when they went to apply for work, it didn't mean anything out in a lot of the other workforce trades. So this will provide an opportunity for folks who want to enter a trade and enter an apprenticeship program the opportunity to receive an associate's degree. The four-year idea came from they work part-time and go to school part-time, basically. So an associate's degree is a two-year track. So we'll be looking at there. I believe there are 16 nationally accredited apprenticeship programs, and the HEC we'll look into those and find which ones have four-year programs and then which additional courses will be needed to be able to qualify for the associate degrees. And the idea is that when you enter the apprenticeship program, you'll be able to choose your community college. And then as you finish modules, you'll be able to send your modules into the community college for a small fee. And as you complete your modules at the time that you're finished with your apprenticeship program, then you'll not only have your certificate for the apprenticeship program, but you'll also have an associate's degree. So that if something were to happen and they weren't in the trade anymore, it certainly would provide them some opportunity that they are so deserving of. These are not just programs that just focus on a trade, and I think Representative Holvey can talk to that here in a little bit. But we spent a lot of time working with a lot of folks, and you're going to hear from them today. I felt like the HEC and the commission, the division under the HEC that does the accreditation piece, was the perfect place to look at the curriculum. The curriculum that the apprenticeship programs have are proprietary to them. They've spent a lot of time and money developing those, and this is one way to put it all in one place, let one entity decide what those what that looks like, and then allow for all community colleges to be able to offer those. So with that said, there's going to be some others you're going to hear from, and I'll let Representative Holvey give you some of his background.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Reardon and committee, and thanks for hearing this bill, and thank you to Representative Hack for enlightening me that she had this bill. This is a great issue, one that I really like, and for the record, I'm State Representative Paul Holvey from District 8, South Lane County.
Thank you.
So I have come from the trades myself, spent all my life in the trades, and the Carpenter Union, actually, and spent about 12 years as a Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee chair, off and on. We kind of rotate chairs in those committees sometimes. And I will say that, a lot of the main trades, they have really rigorous programs that actually include a lot of educational components to it, an incredible amount of math, science, English language issues. We in the Carpenters Union, we also have we teach English as a second language for those that don't speak English as well. So we really have a pretty robust program when it comes to the educational component. And then you also, of course, have the on-the-job components of apprenticeship programs. And in another realm, I just want to say that I also serve on the State Workforce Investment Board for a few years. And this issue has been brought up by myself and a few others in that venue, that the HECS also involved in that. And we have been advocating for quite some time that they take a look at credentialing these programs for academic credit. That it just seems like a really important thing to do for our workforce and for businesses when they're trying to hire a skilled workforce. That credentialing would be really important, really helpful, and allow people that, especially apprentices who are in apprenticeship programs, who might have some downtime, to also pick up some extra components of their education to help them get that associate's degree. And so when I saw this bill, I said, this is a bill that's long overdue. And I commend this to you. I encourage you to do everything you can to listen to everybody's concerns. If they have concerns, try to figure out how to solve those and pass this bill on. I really think it would be a great component to our workforce training, and also providing that skilled workforce that we need for the future. There's a lot of old people in the trades, and we need that younger generation to come in. And one of the problems with keeping apprentices engaged sometimes is a function of whether they have work, and they need those on-the-job hours. But in addition, when things get slow, something like this would motivate them to further their education at the same time. So thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you both for bringing this bill. I think a very good concept. When we think about education, I think about it from a global perspective, and thinking about all the career technical programs, apprenticeship programs, all the way to 4-year degrees. I'm sure you got some pushback from maybe the community colleges, and I'm interested to hear what they have to say, because I understand that there's some I'm curious to hear what they have to say, but I understand that there's some apprenticeship programs already that are run by community colleges, and they do earn credit, and then certainly there's the apprenticeship programs that are probably union based that you don't earn credit. You become part of the union as opposed to getting a degree. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair Reardon and Vice Alonzo Leon. I don't know if I can speak accurately to that and how that world exists right now with that. I know many community colleges are moving forward with options like this. In many of the old days, you're correct. Some of the community colleges offered their own apprenticeship programs for folks that were largely used for the non-union sector because most of the unions had their own apprenticeship programs. As was mentioned, they're somewhat proprietary because they're really proud. They put a lot of work and a lot of money into them that is not state money. It is not public dollars. Those are all private dollars that the contractors and the employees actually share in the expense. So, you know, there's been a little bit of divide, perhaps, between community colleges and the trades historically on these issues. But I think those days are past, and I'm thankful for that. So, you know, I'm not sure I can speak specifically about your question accurately.
I'll give a little to their Chair Rudin and Vice Chair Alonzo Leon. I haven't had any of the community colleges come in opposition. In fact, I am thinking they're going to come in favor of. That's what I was told today anyway. They do offer some of their own, yes. But again, it does go back on part of this to the proprietary issues. And this is a way to have, like I had said before, an entity that has no skin in the game to look at the curriculum and to be able to say, 4 years, if you have an apprenticeship program that's 4 years, these are the additional classes that you would take. And really, it just opens the door for more of what some of the community colleges are already doing. Mm-hmm. So we're not taking anything away. We're actually saying let's do more of it mm-hmm. if they do already have some of those. So it's just more opportunity. And I think when you talk about the CTE, as a parent, a lot of times if our kids want to go onto a trades program and they don't have a degree, I think oftentimes parents shy away from that because they think, well, if you're going to get into a trade and you don't get a degree, there's concern there. Where now they could say, you know, I can get into the carpenter's trade or my husband was in the elevator trade, 5 years of school, came out with no degree but a certificate. Well, if our son wanted to do that and he had an opportunity to get a degree along with that, I'd be more inclined. So I think from a parent's perspective, to know that if you can get into the trades and get a degree at the same time and go through your apprenticeship program, I think it's a win for all sides.
And just to follow up on that a little bit, just a touch, I think historically also it's been a really big challenge for the academic community to really figure out how to establish those academic equivalencies, mm-hmm. You know, because that, you know, there. That's an evolving conversation, I think. And so I think, that's one of the discussions we had at the State Workforce Investment Board, who was interested in copying the apprenticeship model that the trades have and expanding it to different sectors of industries. And there's quite a few businesses and industries that are actually doing that right now. But the conversation of trying to establish what those academic equivalencies would be for those programs takes an examination of those programs. And so I am assuming that that's some of the work that will be involved in making this happen.
Follow-up, Chair.
Yeah, please.
Well, I just want to say, as I mentioned earlier, that I think this is a great bill. I think that it is time for us to be looking at adding or putting credit to courses that people are taking, if that's going to help create additional opportunities for them. I'm excited to hear what the community colleges have to say, and I'm excited for the potential work that can go to making this happen. I think this is an awesome direction. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, Frank, thank you.
So there's one more question.
But maybe before you leave, Fred Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representatives, for being here. Pardon me?
I recognized Rep. Bynum.
Oh, you
even
did.
Though you were doing a nice wave.
At least we're getting.
Yeah, we don't have a problem. We're getting.
As you were saying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say you can earn 49 credits through working through McDonald's hamburgerology program, and you can almost have your associate's degree. So I think that this is a public hearing, so I'm going to listen with open ears and an open mind. But if you can earn almost your associate's degree from working at a hamburger place, then I think that it's appropriate that you should be able to earn your associate's degree from working as a trade apprentice, so, or learning as a trade apprentice. So. There we go. Mr. Chair.
Rep. Johnson, would you
care? I appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Hack, for this idea. I think it's a good one. I'm just listing some ways in which I think it makes sense for us. First of all, it builds on our 40-40-20 efforts, right? We're talking about that middle bucket there, that associates. We already recognize apprenticeship as a component of the middle 40, but I think this would give it even more validity, and it makes sense to give some sort of academic credit for trade experience and just elevate that. But I think that also leads into Measure 98, as we hopefully can fully fund and implement that as we're providing greater CTE-type courses and inspiration for students to show them that it's not just about going on to college, but a career that, and here's an associate's degree to give that training another sense of validity and so forth. But then third would be, I think this could potentially create some incentives for our community colleges to look anew at apprenticeship programs, because I do think there's still a disparity in the state regarding availability, geographical proximity and convenience to access apprenticeship programs. And perhaps this could, you know, lead some of our colleges to take another fresh look at that if they're over in Blue Mountain or Treasure Valley or wherever, and to see how are they serving industry and serving, you know, kids and students in that part of the state adequately. So I think it makes a lot of great sense. So, and just a brief little Google search shows there's all kinds of stuff out there on nationally certified apprenticeship programs. And one of the problems they're trying to address is that sometimes there isn't enough emphasis on national standards, that sometimes there can be state standards, and then those certificates are not portable. But we're trying to latch onto the national standards where we have that kind of across-the-board recognition, so I think you hit on it. So anxious to hear what the colleges say, but I think it's a great idea.
Great. Well, just a comment. I'm pretty certain most of the union apprenticeship programs are portable around the country, yep, and in Canada and a few other places as well.
I want to appreciate the comments from my committee members, too. I think they have a great appreciation for what we're trying to do here. And apprenticeships are, to me, they're a form of education that should be expanded. It's a fantastic model. Other countries have hundreds of apprenticeship programs, and that's what we should be doing that. And it should be used much more broadly. So I think this is great. We recognize it and move a step forward. So thank you. And,
great.
Yeah, I'd like to call up Josh Tompkins, Megan Beyer, and Dan Cushing, please. And I found in the world of CTE apprenticeships and all of this that people get really excited and they want to talk about it a lot. I'm going to encourage you today to be a little bit more concise, and you know, we could have additional offline conversations perhaps, but we do need to keep things moving along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this committee for having us, sir, for having me today, for this opportunity to support this great bill. I will be brief. I've got a lot here. My name is Josh Tompkins. I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors, Pacific Northwest. Briefly, our association across the country represents more than 200 state-sponsored apprenticeship programs. In the Pacific Northwest, our chapter, we have four programs. That's HVAC, sheet metal, sprinkler fitters, and testing, adjusting and balancing. And we're always looking for opportunities to fill the needs for apprenticeship and training in the construction industry. In the past, ABC Pacific Northwest has worked, as mentioned just previously, with Portland Community College on apprenticeship programs, not currently, but it shows the willingness and ability to work with institutions of higher education outside of the trades. ABC endorses this legislation for several reasons, perhaps the most important of which is added flexibility. An associate's degree provides apprentices with an additional certification to seek more opportunity within their companies, including management, future ownership opportunities. For instance, one Pacific Northwest member comes to mind who's a former HVAC apprentice, now owns his own company, employs four apprentices that are in our program, in addition to 20-plus additional employees. Finally, I'm honored to deliver this to this committee as a representative of both ABC and as an advocate for great training and growth opportunities within the construction industry. Thank you to Representative Hack for sponsoring this really good bill. We like it. We're happy to support it. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks.
Nathan.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Beyer, and I'm here on behalf of the Sheet Metal Workers Local 16, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Locals 48 and 280 in support of House Bill 3335. Apprenticeship programs are one of the oldest forms of technical education in the world. Our apprentices spend over 750 hours in the classroom and thousands of hours in the field during their five-year programs. As part of their education, they are exposed to and required to learn very technical math and science skills that apply directly to their training and future work. The electrical, sheet metal, and HVAC trades are CTE STEM careers. Over the last few decades, the respect for and understanding of apprenticeship programs has declined as expectations for students to receive a college degree has risen. Many students and their parents are unaware of the appeal and benefit of these programs. After successfully finishing their apprenticeship, they will be able to have a career with the potential to make over six figures a year and also receive a healthy benefit package that would support their family comfortably. Importantly, apprentices are paid to learn and do not have to pay for their education with our programs. They graduate debt-free. The ability for our apprentices to be recognized as having an AA degree after completing their apprenticeship would add another layer of legitimacy and respect to these programs. It would help recruit students to these fields. Parents and students alike would appreciate that they are receiving a well-respected degree to go along with their potential career. We would very much welcome an opportunity to be a part of this conversation on this idea as we move forward, and urge your support.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Dan Cushing. I'm here representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, which represents approximately 25,000 construction workers, 21 member unions that are highly skilled in a wide array of crafts. These men and women are an intricate part of Oregon's workforce, our region's economy, and future economic prosperity. And I'm also here representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, or NECA. NECA is a signatory contractor that works with the skilled trades, with the skilled trade workers in the building trades that I just mentioned. On behalf of these building trades and signatory contractors, I'm here to testify in support of HB 3335. The union construction industry is known for its outstanding apprenticeship programs, which train men and women to become journeymen in the skilled trades. These apprenticeship programs are 3, 4, and 5 years long. They take place in classroom settings, as well as hands-on learning environments and on-the-job training. These programs are paid for jointly by the signatory contractors and the trades without a dime of taxpayer dollars. HB 3335 will enable workers who journey out or complete this program to earn an associate's degree from a community college. So if they want to later extend their education to a bachelor's degree, they may do so. An associate's degree is also a formal recognition of the education and training these men and women have received and the proficiency they've demonstrated in their trades. We have long felt that our programs are a form of higher education, and we feel it's high time they're treated like that in state law. We want to thank Rep. Hack for bringing this bill, and if there's anything that we are upset about with the bill, it's that we didn't think of it ourselves. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? So let's see, there are hundreds of apprenticeships, there people graduate debt-free and are no taxpayer dollars. Did I get that message right? Okay.
Need more.
sounds good here. So thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And if I may, call up Joel Fisher, John Wyckoff, please. And was there anybody else in the from the public that wished to testify on this bill? Okay, I see nobody clamoring up.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, here on behalf of the Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. Here to talk about the importance, sort of looking at this through the context of our state goal of 40-40-20 and ensuring that all of our students are graduating, you know, high school at a minimum and going on to receive 40% receiving an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And already we recognize the apprenticeships as part of that middle 40. We'd like to recognize the great work that the community colleges have already been doing in this space. And John will talk about that in a little bit. Also, I'd just like to quickly recognize my own hard work. I feel like I should get at least a minor in hamburgerology given my time in college. Those are not... There's nothing to actually account for that, though. So we think this is a good bill. I'd like to thank the sponsors for their hard work on it, and especially the community colleges for creating such a great system that we can now expand on.
We've heard some advocates of proficiency testing, and so if you want your degree in hamburgerology, you're going to have to prove that you learned something.
I'm Chair Reardon. I'm absolutely up for that.
You're on.
John, join in, please.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff with the Oregon Community College Association, and also for the record, we will not be giving Joel Fisher credit for that. There are just a few quick points I'd like to make. First, I would like to thank Representative Hack and the folks who have spoken for, in part for the acknowledgement that this is work that the community colleges are doing. Most of our colleges offer up to an associate's in various trades areas. What we do hear from the field is that a lot of times what will happen is someone will get to kind of their journeyman level and leave before they get their associate's. We also see that in fields like wind turbine technician, where folks just get jobs before they finish the associate's. But a path may exist currently. And we are seeing folks come back, and this is mostly anecdotal information, come back with their... who've got their journeyman sort of certification and then come in to get their associates to kind of do some a management foreman type position. And so we really very much value the partnerships with apprenticeship programs, have been doing this work to make sure that students do get credits in these areas. But there are areas where it where we still need to do that work and create further pathways. And I think this sort of recognizes this. And the last thing that I would say is this does, I think, in some way, you know, the community colleges supported adding apprenticeship into the 40-40-20. It just made a lot of sense, and we will not, we can't reach that goal if you don't really start to look, if you don't really look at that, and it absolutely should be looked at. So these kind of partnerships are things that we have supported and do see as important to the 40-40-20. Just wanted to make sure folks know this is work that is ongoing, and that is something that community colleges are already committed to and have been working with both. And the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And the last point I would make, too, is I do think it's important, to remember that a lot of these partnerships really do happen at the local level. While the Higher Education Coordinating Commission does have, like, final approval on new degrees, and that's perfectly appropriate in new programs, this work really happens at the local level. That is where these partnerships get created. That is where these programs get sort of co-developed. And so just wanted to point that out as well.
I'd just like to highlight how many times 40-40-20 has come up in this discussion. There's been some indication of others, not anybody I talked to very much, but that's not an important goal, but it absolutely helps frame this discussion and has put the emphasis on that middle 40 where it belongs. Whether those are right numbers or not, I don't know, but they're good, valid numbers. They help us reach common understanding on where we're going, and I think it's absolutely essential that we continue to be able to use those numbers and advance the cause for people that just learn in different ways and reach their life goals by different paths. So thank you for your support of this bill, and Rep. Johnson, did you care to add
to
that?
Thank you, Chair. So John, I don't know how in depth you guys have thought through this, but would there be some level of coursework required at the college or certified from by the college in order to be able to award an associate's, or could it solely be done on a body of work that is over here but has a level of certification from a third party?
Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't want to get too far over my skis on this. On the apprenticeship side, have a particularly granular understanding of the programs. Mm-hmm. I believe they would do some coursework within the college. I would think they would, and if we're offering the credit, we would, by accreditation standards, you'd usually have to. But I'd have to get back to you on that with something more granular than what I currently
have in my head. At least learn a school fight song or something.
Right.
Okay. I think we're done. Oops.
Rep Reschke, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question might be for you or for them. I see may have fiscal impact, may have revenue impact. I'm just wondering when those statements would be issued.
Prior to the work session. So I need to say that we're going to have a work session and then create the fiscal. So
okay. Thank you. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. And we ask if there's anybody else, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm closing public hearing on House Bill 3335. And is it Jean?
Yeah.
I think it's me. And what I will give you a gavel. Somebody. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3003. And Laura, if you want to read that.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3003 would require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop a form requiring community colleges to annually detail how state monies for provision of workforce development training were used and the degree to which this use of state monies achieved the purpose for which monies were expended.
Okay, let's get ready to grill him.
Here we go.
Thank you, Rep. Reardon.
Well, thank you, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, for having me here today, members of the committee. Seems odd being sitting out here. For the record, I am Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, and I'll make this very brief. House Bill 3033 is just a very simple bill, and the simplest way to explain it is we send a lot of money out to the community colleges to do workforce-related work. And what I would like is just a brief indication from them, what are you doing with the money? So let me read the prepared statement, see if it supports what I just said. This testimony is going to be short and brief. Did that. Bill requires that Higher Ed Coordinating Commission develop a form, I'm thinking one page or less, and that the community colleges that receive the state funds for this workforce development purposes, they would complete the form, share what they use the money for, and the outcome achieved that they were intending to solve or what problem they were trying to solve. So be an annual report. First report isn't due until mid-November 2018. And I understand it might take some time for community colleges, Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to work out the best way to collect that data and report the data, but I'm confident they can come together and create it. So really just a very simple process to try to get a little bit of information about what's really being done with the money. I think it's not trying to impose a lot of work or do anything expensive, just get some accountability built in a little bit. So any questions?
Any questions from group? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, are you referring to grants primarily for specific purposes, general fund allotments? I'm trying to think are you referring to grants for this purpose from the state?
Yes, grant money that goes out for workforce.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions from the committee? Nope. Okay. Anyone from the public that would like to testify? Okay, thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3003.
We feel like we let him off a little easy.
I wanted to know where he got
to. Thank you. Okay. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3288. Laura, would you please give us a brief summary? Now, Laura, would you give us a brief summary?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3288 would require each public institution of higher education to submit annual report to the Higher Educating Coordinating Commission that includes the ratio of non-instructional professional staff to faculty, the number of new non-instructional professional positions, the contracted wage of each new and existing non-instructional professional position, and the reason for the creation of each of these positions.
Is there anybody else who's going to testify on this? Rep. Wisnett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, honorable members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Rep, House District 53. A priority issue for me during my legislative career has been to reduce the cost of higher education and thus increase asset access. Another legislative priority is transparency and accountability. House Bill 3288 is common sense legislation that supports these legislative goals. It will provide Oregonians a greater understanding of how their tax dollars and personal dollars are being spent at institutions of higher education. You know, any education publication you read, pick up today, most of them talk about the administrative bloat is a serious problem in universities contributing to the rising cost of tuition. A recent joint study by the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and the American Institutes for Research found that the number of non-academic administrative and professional employees at colleges and universities have doubled over the past 25 years. That comes from the Huffington Post. The U.S. Department of Education has determined that university administrators have increased by 60% from 1993 to 2009. A 2010 University of Arkansas study revealed that from 1993 to 2007, spending on administration increased as much as twice the rate of spending on research and teaching at 198 of the top universities in the country. So the House Bill 3288, as published now, requires each public university and community college in Oregon to submit the data that I'm not going to read. It's in the bill again. But since this bill has been scheduled, I received a lot of concerns from the university community about the time and staff to provide this data. Thus, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm willing to work with the HEC to draft an amendment that would request only a narrative report from each of the four-year universities, not all of our community colleges, on their efforts to manage this cost driver. I do not support the legislature micromanaging our universities, but I do believe it's fair to ask our universities to confirm what they're doing and how they can control cost and tuition. I hope the supporters of the original bill will understand that a task force or a more elaborate report would have resulted in a financial impact and probably killed the bill. However, the amendment can provide us and the public a look at Oregon's administrative staffing and how it's being addressed from a 30,000-foot level. So I'm asking this committee to support the issue described in this bill and allow me to find an acceptable amendment to pass without a large financial impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wisnett, for asking these questions about transparency and how we're spending the money. My suspicion, and you can tell me what your suspicion is that some of the non-teaching positions are related to questions around compliance. And I looked through our bill book today, and I saw that we had compliance in the athletic department, and we were talking about compliance earlier to other things. So are we part of the problem? In the proliferation of non-academic
Mr. Chair and Representative Byam, yes, very okay. much. We okay. are part of the problem. And that's why with this bill, I said, let's, you know, simple report, narrative report, that you're aware of this situation and you're looking at it and addressing it, would not hopefully result in a lot of staff time to do that. And then if the legislature sees a real problem, then we can dig in and get more details. Okay. So, yes, ma'am, you're very correct. We're the problem. The federal government's the problem. And the universities, you know, do get a lot of requirements. If they were city or state government, they'd call them a unfunded mandate. So that's why I'm willing to work with the universities to find how they could report to us in a simple narrative letter report on are they looking at this issue and they're trying.
Thank you.
Question just occurred to me that when you're looking at non-instructional, what types of positions are you expecting to see? Would that include things? Are you concentrating on the educational mission, or does it go out beyond that?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. I sit on the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. So we're going through. We're just starting getting into the university system. But I made a comment in committee this week that we're getting ready in Central Oregon to do something that doesn't happen in a lifetime, is build a four-year university. And I've been involved on the sideline from the beginning of this concept. I actually, in the legislature, was the longest one here from that district that's had to fight to keep this this idea alive, to have a four-year university in Central Oregon. Been a lot of problems in growth. Believe it or not, the recession was one of the best things that could happen to our objective, because more people went back to college during the recession. And so our numbers went up in Central Oregon. We got a lot of people committing money to build a four-year university. But what one of the things that we're doing is we've already built a dormitory student center. And it just... you know, the universities, in my opinion, are competing for those students, and we're building resorts, not dormitories, and things like that that drives up the cost. You know, they feel they have to compete. We've given their semi-independent status, so we're going to, big question in the Ways and Means is going to be what tuition increase we approve, because they've got to pay their staff and do their work. So I just think that there's a lot of things. I recently visited the University of Oregon campus, and saw a lot of building and dormitories and all that. And recently I was at the great university, the oldest land-grant college in the United States, in Chapel Hill. And I happened to notice that they've got luxury private condos all over, with swimming pools and athletic facilities and all this that the students. So, you know, it's tough. It's tough out there in the bringing in the students. So I think that a lot of the people are not faculty. They're not teachers. I've been to China. I've seen how, you know, some of the Chinese and how many people in the classes and how they go 6 days a week and things like that. And that's not the way we want it maybe in America. But those are things and those are positions that I think we want to see. I understand they have to have marketing. They have to go out and get found, you know, support and things like that. You know, and we, as I, back to the last question is, we're part of the problem. We got to keep, you know, the requirements we're putting on them to go out and pay more staff to do things that are not teaching our students. So I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chair. And I got the basketball in. That was cool.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, is there a definition? Is there a definition for Tar Heel?
Oh my gosh! You always screwed me up today, Johnson.
Just wondering.
It's called basketball teams.
Any other questions now that we have a chance here? I mean,
exactly. We got him.
Where's Chapel Hill?
Yeah. God's country.
If there are no other questions, I think we may have other folks that wanted to testify.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kendall Mason, Corey Jepson, were you wanting to testify?
I could be this one.
Okay. Or maybe it's the next bill. All right. If that's where is she here? Okay, I'm closing public hearing on House Bill 3288, right? And opening a public hearing on House Bill 2965. And Laura, would you do the honors, please?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2965 would establish a task force on workforce development for people with disabilities, requires the task force to review the Council of State Governments and National Conference of State Legislatures report entitled Work Matters, a Framework for States on Workforce Development for People with Disabilities, and to evaluate Oregon's programs related to employing people with disabilities.
How about that? Is that okay?
Okay.
I can go down.
Thank you. So, Vice Chair Wisnett is going to introduce this for us, and we'll turn it over to Mr. Silverstein.
Thank
you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll sit up here because this is a committee bill. This is your bill, committee members. And thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and honorable committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Rep, House District 53. As a member of the National Conference of State Legislators Standing Education Committee, I was appointed to a joint task force of the Council of State Governments, CSG, and NCSL to produce a report on workforce development for people with disabilities. The report was published and presented in December 2016. Since I was not completely familiar with Oregon's programs on workforce development of people with disabilities, I did what too many legislators do. I drafted a bill to establish an Oregon task force to study the task force. Sounds sort of silly, but I think it's going to result in some very good results. Our bill asked that we establish this task force to study the national task force report and recommendations, review Oregon's programs to employ people with disabilities, and then recommend any necessary legislation to improve Oregon's programs. The current bill in front of you requests the Consumer and Business Service Director to direct the Oregon Disabilities Commission to provide staff support to the task force. However, we believe we have agreement to amend the bill to designate the Department of Human Services to provide the staff support for the task force. This is not firm, but I believe we are able to integrate our work into the work that they're already involved into with a few meetings by the task force to get through with some recommendations. Thus, I also want to put on the record that I've received requests to place other agencies on the task force, and I will look doing that and including as many people as feasible to put on the task force, working with the new support staff from Department of Human Services. We'll be supporting those two amendments. I'm very honored, Mr. Chair and committee members, that we have today to testify on the report, Mr. Bobby Silverstein, who is one of the three lead authors of the National CSG NCSL Task Force report. He flew in last night from Washington, D.C., and we really appreciate him take his willingness to do this and report to us on the report. He also informed me today that Governor Brown was just elected president of CSG, if you're a CSG member. In closing, I recommend the committee pass our bill, and after we make some changes administrative to get these people on the task force and the staff support confirmed. So thank you, and look forward to Mr. Silverstein's comments.
Well, Mr. Silverstein, welcome to our committee. I really appreciate your making the trip out here, and I'm going to turn it over to you, but I need to ask you to introduce yourself, of course, and for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Bobby Silverstein. I'm here today representing the State Exchange on Employment and Disability, or what we refer to as the SEED Project. Workforce development is a hot issue amongst all the states. Around the country, many states are recognizing that to do it truly good, effective job in enhancing workforce development, it is critical to make sure that people with disabilities are part of those initiatives. HR House Bill 2965 is a critical bill because it establishes an infrastructure and a systemic strategy for ensuring that people with disabilities are part of those initiatives. As you know, House Bill 2965 describes three primary responsibilities of the task force. The first is to review this report that you have in front of you. Work Matters, a framework for states on workforce development for people with disabilities. The second is to evaluate state programs. And the third is, based on that review of the report and the state programs, to make findings and recommendations. purpose of my testimony today is to give you an overview of what went into writing this report. Why was the report done, the framework in the first place? What was the process used? Who were some of the key members? What were some of the overarching principles that guided the development? And then give you a quick overview of some of the policy options that were identified from a review of state policy across the country. First, a little background. Why? Why was this task force established? Why was this report done? There's a recent report done called 2016 Annual Disability Statistics Compendium. And when we look at some of the data, to give you a big the context, there are 12.6% of the population of folks living in the community are individuals with disabilities. In Oregon, that number is 15.2%. When you look at the employment rate of people with disabilities and compare it to those without disabilities, this is what the report discovered, that only 34.9% of individuals with disabilities age 18 to 64 living in the community are employed. And that's compared to 76% of individuals who are not disabled. In Oregon, the number of individuals with disabilities employed is 37.8% compared to 76.2%, which is a difference of over 38%. When we look at the poverty rate of people with disabilities in the country, we find that 27.1% of individuals with disabilities are living in poverty, compared to 12.3% of non-disabled folks, again, a difference of almost 15%. When we look at Oregon, it's 30.9% of persons with disabilities living in poverty, compared to 13.6% of non-disabled folks, a difference of over 17%. So there's an issue here, and CSG and NCSL recognized this issue, and part of the solution is enhancing employment opportunities. It's the right thing to do for individuals to empower them to live independent lives. It also strengthens the workforce from the perspective of the state. We recognized by the NCSL and CSG coming together that it is important to systematically look at what states were doing to address the employment of people with disabilities. And what was found is that across the country, states are adopting a multifaceted approach, and they are truly designing specific projects, programs, policies that address the employment rate of people with disabilities. We also found how critical it is, in order to move that needle, that there be strong leadership by state policymakers. In recognition of the need to gather this information so that states could learn from each other, CSG and NCSL came together to establish this national task force. As you know, CSG is a nation's only nonpartisan, non-for-profit organization serving all three branches of state government, and the current president is your own governor. NCSL is a bipartisan organization representing and serving legislators and their staff across the country. SEED, or State Exchange on Employment and Disabilities, is a very interesting project funded by the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor Office of Disability Employment Policy. Often when you think of the federal government, you think of one size, the feds telling states what to do, and the states responding. This project is totally different. This project recognizes that the answers to many of the issues are at the state level. And states need their intermediaries, such as CSG and NCSL, to serve as resources to help states adopt policies and learn from their peers around the country. So there is no answer here. There is a facilitation of dialogue, communication, and information and technical assistance that is being provided. I am a member of the SEED team and will be part of the resource to help states pursue and learn more from other states, pursue policy and learn more from other states. So this national task force was convened by CSG in partnership with NCSL under the auspices of the Department of Labor. The goal was to explore issues about the employment of people with disabilities and identify policy options from around the country and use that framework to help facilitate the development of initiatives that include people with disabilities as part of workforce development issues. The National Task Force was co-chaired by the 2016 president of CSG, Governor Jack Markell from Delaware, and State Senator Bo McCoy from Nebraska. There were four subcommittees that were assigned. Each of them had 10 to 12 state policymakers and a number of experts and stakeholders who were non-voting members of the various committees. The four committees dealt with issues ranging from career readiness and employability, hiring, retention, reentry, entrepreneurship, and transportation and technology issues. If you're following the PowerPoint, I just skipped a page because we flipped in terms of headings and topics. In terms of looking at some of the guiding principles, they were the following. Disability is a natural and normal part of the human experience that in no way diminishes a person's right to fully participate in all aspects of society. This is a very key phrase, because if you looked at disability policy 20, 30 years ago, you would have seen a totally different paradigm. It would have said that disability means defective, dependent, vulnerable, in need of fixing. This report is based on the new paradigm that disability is a natural part of the human experience. There are four goals of disability policies that were articulated by the task force. Are equality of opportunity, full participation, which means self-determination for people with disabilities, informed choice, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. The task force recognized that disability can happen and develop at any time. Some folks are born with a developmental disability, some are injured or ill and become disabled over time. Another key theme was the notion of nothing about us, without us, that people with disabilities should be involved at the policy level and the individual level on issues affecting them. People with disabilities are underutilized and experience social and economic disadvantage, and disability inclusion boosts bottom line. This was a very interesting discussion that occurred in many of the subcommittees and at the committee level. Why should we care? Well, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act and state laws, so of course there's a legal requirement. And other people think it's the right thing to do. But what this task force recognizes, yes, those are true. But the real issue is, does it boost the bottom line? Are we talking about ensuring that there's an opportunity for qualified individuals with disabilities to make businesses and states do their job, do it in a more effective way through diversity, inclusion, and initiatives. In terms of the overarching themes, the task force came up with a number: lead by example. States should lead by example. And private employers expect the state to do what they're doing. Adopt robust reporting requirements. We heard the expression, you've heard it before, what gets measured gets done. And so these accountability is critical. Coordination and collaboration was another major theme. Too many people, it's not my job, you go from agency to agency, employers trying to get some help, trying to understand what's going on, they push to three different places instead of the state saying, here, we can help you. Include the concept of universal design. Originally, this was a concept with physical space, but it's been expanded. When you develop a new program, do you take into consideration the needs of the broadest spectrum of your citizens? That's universal design, saying, let's not retrofit a program for people with disabilities or others. Let's take the issues into consideration in the initial design stages. So we developed, and we say we, that is the task force, with the staff support, developed policy options in 2, 4, 5 different areas. Laying the groundwork, preparing for work, getting to and accessing work, staying at work, supporting employment and entrepreneurship. Now, in addition to the PowerPoint, I prepared for all of you a handout. And what this handout does is it walks through and identifies as a checklist the series of policy options that states around the country have developed. And so this is a quick, easy review of some of the ideas that your colleagues around the country have developed, organized by each of these topic areas. And eventually, and that's shortly, this document, Work Matters, is currently on the web. But if you've looked through this, you will see throughout in bold references to states. Shortly, every reference to a state will have a hyperlink to the state legislation or the state regulations. So this task force, the state task force, if they're interested in a certain issue, will be able to click on what other states have done rather than reinventing the wheel or starting from scratch. And so I'm going to just give you a feel and flavor for some of the recommendations or policy options, I should say, that other states have developed. Under the heading of states as model employers, which is one of 13 categories of recommendations including in this report, here are some of the ideas. Some states have developed formal mechanisms, bills. Some have done joint resolutions. Others have done executive orders. Establishing an infrastructure. Some states, actually, like Maryland, has a cabinet-level position for disability policy, so that at cabinet meetings, the disability perspective is addressed. Other states have done interagency committees or task force, like your bill. Many states have required a strategic plan for how to ensure that people with disabilities are included in workforce development, and including reporting and accountability measures. Some have hiring goals for state agencies for people with disabilities. Some states have developed hiring systems, including fast-track hiring systems, where a person with a disability can be hired without going through the civil service process, as long as they're certified by, for example, your state vocational rehabilitation agency. Others have developed policies for waiving or modifying civil service exams, offering on-site accommodations. Here are just a set of examples, but there are numerous additional ones. Some states have developed a centralized accommodation fund, some at the state level, some at the agency level. Think about it if you're a manager at a division and you find the most qualified person happens to be a person with a disability who needs significant accommodations, and you have a limited budget. Are you going to come up with an excuse for not hiring that person, or are you going to say, I'm going to hire the most qualified person? Well, if the issue of accommodation is done by the department or at a state level, you don't have to worry about that issue. All you have to worry about is hiring the most qualified person. I'm sorry, the second recommendation category is build capacity of private and nonprofit sector. What can the state government do to enhance employment of people with disabilities by employers? A number of states said, I need information. But you've got three different agencies telling me different things. Can you have a single point of contact like South Dakota has? A lot of VR agencies around the country have somebody specifically earmarked to work with employers. That way, employers know who to go to if they have questions. In a number of states, they have required contractors who contract with the state government to do affirmative action, not only for women minorities, but include people with disabilities as well. There are about five or six states in the country that do that. There are a number of states that have tax incentives, income tax credits, for hiring people with disabilities. There are other states that have tax credits for employers who provide supports, expensive supports, or make architectural barriers. These are just, again, a set of examples of what some states are doing. Some states, number three, external and internal focus on disability awareness, making sure that people understand disability policy, that understand the move from the old paradigm of defective vulnerability, fixing people, to the new paradigm that disability is a natural part of the human experience. I'm sorry. The fourth category is interagency coordination and collaboration. People in the various task force talked about the notion of, can I pull together how we communicate state resources? What's available? Can we blend and braid resources Blending resources means taking from different pools and putting into one pool. Freighting means keeping the resources separate but having a collaborative effort. Oregon Youth Transition Program is doing a lot of this blending and braiding as an example. Entering into formal interagency agreements between VR and education, between VR and the workforce, between VR and Medicaid agency, the MRDD ID agency, and the mental health agency, to make sure if we have an employment initiative, we're all working together, we're blending or braiding of resources. The next broad category that is included again in this report is preparing for work. And this group looked at three basic topic areas. Career readiness. For example, many states are using career development plans. Oregon person-centered planning model was brought up as an example. What is this doing? Are we saying that people with disabilities should be included in career development plans? Or is the state saying, no, there should be an exemption? Well, a lot of states are saying we need to include people with disabilities in these career development plans and coordinate them with their IEPs, individual education programs. Skill development and job exploration, making sure that children and students with disabilities are having inclusive work-based learning experiences just like their non-disabled peers. And family engagement, to make sure that families, including parents and guardians of kids with disabilities, are part of advisory committees, part of the process. The next broad category was getting to and accessing work opportunities. Transportation is mentioned as a major, major issue. Are there transportation options that are reliable and accessible for people with disabilities? Accessible information and communication technology. Think about the dependence of all of us on websites, online systems, intranets, application systems, apps. What are we doing to ensure that all people have effective and meaningful opportunity to take advantage of the information and data that is provided through websites? Many states are requiring that state agencies ensure that their websites, their online systems, are accessible, and including references to specific standards for what constitutes accessibility. At the federal level, we're now coming together in one set of standards. They're called WCAG 2.0 A and AA, Web Contact Accessibility Guidelines, international standards adopted now in terms of the federal government in what's called Section 508 of the Rehab Act. We're all coming together in a single. So many states are adopting requirements, at least for state agencies. Some are looking at expanding it to others. But there are models in terms of what states are doing in this regard, including efforts to encourage vendors to make sure that what they are selling to the state meets these accessibility standards. And the final one is ensuring that the built environment, including housing and infrastructure, is accessible for people with disabilities. Another major topic that was discussed by the task force is the concept of staying at work, returning to work, where you have people who do not have a disability. They're working. They become injured or ill on the job. What happens then? Some states are developing policies for the private sector. Some are developing specific programs that deal with the public sector, the state government. Special programs, Delaware just developed a program for state employees in terms of stay at work, return to work. Oregon is one of the leaders in terms of state money for benefit counseling to supplement federal money, because one of the issues for people with disabilities is work disincentives, that you have Social Security, you get other benefits, but if you work, you lose your benefits. So how do you deal with the trade-off? Oregon is one of the leaders already in terms of making sure that people have the counseling they need so that they understand what's possible in terms of work. The last topic that was discussed by the task force was supporting self-employment and entrepreneurship. To make sure that your workforce development system, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, the new provisions dealing with career development are truly embraced at the state level in terms of implementation at the American Job Centers. But there are also interesting strategies, policies that are being developed around the country with respect to disability-owned businesses, just like women-owned and minority-owned businesses, to include people with disabilities in terms of some of the state set-asides. And there are other states that are providing technical assistance, support to help provide low-interest loans, grants, angel investors, mentoring for disabled-owned businesses. So in conclusion, in terms of my testimony, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have in terms of completing my briefing, is that the bill, House Bill 2965, provides the infrastructure and the systemic approach to identifying best promising and emerging practices by borrowing and from the lessons learned in other states, rather than having to start from scratch. Here's a structure that maximizes the likelihood that the state of Oregon will look at this in a systemic way, learn from other states, and make sure that people with disabilities are part of workforce development.
Wow. There's a lot to think about. Questions or comments?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this great presentation. It's very comprehensive. And it sounds like the interest of taking a review or reviewing our own Department of Disabilities in conjunction with the Department of Labor to see how and where we can better improve areas to support our community members with disabilities. I think that's a great task. Can you tell me what other states have done around the cost of this analysis and reviewing states' departments? Just kind of trying to get a grasp on the scope, how big this project could potentially be.
Well, again, this project is as small or as big as you want it to be, because this report does not have any answers. It has a number of options. And so you may choose to adopt strategic plans. State is a model employer, and that's all you're going to do. Many of these recommendations do not cost, because they are ensuring that other things that you're doing include people with disabilities as well. It is Some of them may be a program, but many of them may not be. Maybe the tax incentives will have a cost implication because there might be less, because you're incentivizing employers to hire people with disabilities. But there again, you can learn from other states because they had to do a fiscal analysis. And so if you like the idea, you can call them up and say, what was the cost implications? And if we do it a different way, there may be others. So all this is a resource, 100 ideas. You can pick one, you can pick 10, but the nice thing about it is you can find out from others what their experience was, including costs.
Follow up?
Yes.
So I guess then my question is to Representative Wisnett, and I'd like to hear from you again. I guess maybe I thought we were going to have some sort of kind of basic understanding of what Oregon is doing already. Do you have a sense of what's going on already? In preparing and you're thinking around this bill, I guess I need to have a better understanding of where we're at and where we're headed.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, my colleagues from the Department of Human Services, or that's part of the task force, is looking at what we have. Bobby pointed out several, a couple of times where Oregon's leading in these efforts. And if you look what he was talking about, I wanted to question if it's okay, Mr. Chair. For did you say online that you could look? Can you link these and pull up those more examples, or just it's in?
It will be online. Right now, the report is online, but CSG is now working on the capacity to every time there's a state in bold, you could click on it and find the specific legislation or regulations. And that is in the process of being developed. Now, I identified by looking at the report about four or five places where the state of Oregon was specifically mentioned. In terms of state goals, page 24, page 49, person-centered planning model for youth, page 76, employee at injury program, which you have a stay at work program, page 77, benefit counseling, which I made reference to, page 42, the youth transition program in terms of blending and braiding, and also you have an employment first program, which is mentioned on page 41.
I think my follow-up, some brief comments.
We have two more presenters as well.
Okay. If this was, I appreciate you coming out and speaking and doing such a great job with the presentation. The thing that my working on the task force, it amazed me that how much people with disabilities do contribute and how they can contribute to our society, to the workforce, and all these things. I'll never forget one of the things is we talked about how when a person with disabilities is applying for a job, you go in and sell yourself on what you can do for that company, not what you need personally for your to be able to work there. And I think that was a real strong, left me with a good point. I think also that your presentation and saying we need to look and see what we're doing in the state of Oregon. If you're going to ask private companies, or you got to look and see what the state of Oregon is doing to employ people with disabilities and how we're, addressing that and helping that. If we don't set the standard, how can you expect private industry or task them to do it? So that's what we're going to do. I don't have all the background as far as what the state of Oregon is doing right now. That's what we're going to find out. First, we'll look at the report and then see what Oregon's doing. And they're, as I said, what I've learned from the Department of Human Services, they're going through this now and looking at some things that they need to focus. So I think it's going to integrate really good and hopefully improve what Oregon is doing to help people with disabilities be employed. It's so big. I mean, that's what surprises me. This week, many of you maybe had a visit by people that are deaf. And they told me they don't feel that they're being always addressed in when you're trying to look for employment of people that are deaf. So, this is, I think I'm the only one. Early in my legislative career here, I'll never forget, we passed a bill on the floor, and I says, God, what are we doing? But we changed all the laws in Oregon, and you should be proud of this. We changed all the laws in Oregon to say, take away disabled people and say people with disabilities, to put people first instead of saying a disabled person. It's people with disabilities. And I think.
And that law and that approach is the recognition by policymakers of that proposition that disability, like race, like gender, is a natural, normal part of the human experience. That should not in any way diminish a person's right to fully participate in all aspects of our society. And as a kind of follow-up to your question, and it's maybe a minor issue, but the SEED project, we're there to help also. If you need additional research, if you need drafting, we're there to provide the technical assistance, CSG, NCSL, and SEED staff, to help your task force, to help you so that the costs of trying to find out, for example, what others are doing, or drafting models that take from five different state and you come up with your own, we're there to help and provide the resources to help you do that.
I just have to say something, because I can't help but think from a personal experience I'd like to share just a tiny bit of that. Back in the days when I was a young lad, I grew up with a sister who had many mental health problems. I mean, half a dozen different things, long list. And in those days, it was a matter of, at some point, finding a place to warehouse the person. Literally warehouse that person. And then we became more enlightened, and they went into group homes and so forth. But instead of finding ways to include the person, help them become productive, they were shunted away and treated horribly. I mean, their physical needs were taken care of, but not in no way were they helped to become productive citizens and reach the fullest potential. So that's my personal story. I take this very close to heart, and I think that this needs to be part of a lot of discussions, many of the things that we're doing. I hadn't thought about it in this context, so I really appreciate your bringing this to us and helping us understand better at least the questions and maybe some directions that we might take. So very impactful, at least to me. So no other questions. We do have two other folks who are going to testify. Kendall.
Thank you for the opportunity to share some of these policy options with you.
Thank you. And Kendall Mason, Corey Jepson.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, Vice Chair Wisnett, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today on House Bill 2965 concerning the Task Force on Workforce Development for People with Disabilities. My name is Kendall Mason, and I am a political and policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. Earlier this year, CareWorks, an organization focused on the enormity and significance of the care economy, released a report on the state of care in Oregon. And I did submit this report to OLIS, and so it's listed in the materials section. the report details the increasing number of peoples who qualify for services and supports in the state, while at the same time pointing out the crisis of the workforce itself. So not only is there a shortage of workers, but the fact that the work is often underpaid and underappreciated means it's also hard to attract new people to the work. And as the legislature considers the value of a task force looking into workforce development, we'd like to just ask that the work of the task force is done through the lens of the current state of need for workforce development across the sector of people who work with people with disabilities. SEIU represents more than 25,000 home care and personal support workers, and many of the consumers of home care services are people with physical disabilities. And it is the duty of the home care worker to make sure their clients are fully integrated into the community and living lives of independence, dignity, and choice. This loosely translates to the fact that home care workers often help facilitate the employment of their clients. And with this in mind, we'd like to simply ask that the focus of this task force also include the need to invest in workforce development of home care workers and personal support workers, so that the employment of people with disabilities is inclusive of the workers who make sure their transition into employment and continued employment is seamless. We will need a robust and well-trained workforce of home care and personal support workers to ensure that people with disabilities are not just gainfully employed, but also successful in their chosen field of work, and that they have the resources they need to continue to live independently. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Welcome. Well, Chair Reardon, representative or members of the committee, for the record, my name is Corey Jepson. I'm here representing the Oregon Resource Association, or ORA, today. We're the statewide association that includes nonprofits and for-profit organizations that support people with developmental disabilities and other disabilities all around the state. Our members provide the vast majority of services that are contracted through ODDS for services for people with disabilities. 2017 is a landmark year for ORA. This is our 50th anniversary. And just to mirror some of the things that Bobby Silverstein said and my colleague to my left, your right, employment has been a huge issue for that entire 50-year history of our organization. I would say that today our members are really on the front lines of state policy regarding Employment First, the settlement of the Lane v. Brown lawsuit. They're working really hard to transform themselves right now to meet the, you know, all of the latest nuances of state and federal policy regarding employment of people with disabilities. In a word, I think they're the backbone of our service delivery system. With regard to HB 2965, I just want to say that we support the bill, and I want to thank Representative Wisnett for including us in his amendments, so thank you for that. We do have a couple considerations that we'd hope the committee and the resulting task force would keep in mind as they go about their business. One is it's really important that we sustain a robust and sustainable provider network of employment services. It's absolutely vital to the ongoing success of people with disabilities in the state. And I also just want to make sure that we maximize choice in where, how, and for whom individuals with disabilities want to work. At ORA, we believe that state policy should add to the pool of available choices rather than take options away from people. I did submit some written testimony that goes into more detail on that, but for now, I just want to say thank you for to let me speak, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them.
Any questions for this panel? Rep. Longo-Leon.
Yeah, it's not so much a question. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming to speak. Kendall, thank you for bringing up the opportunity to discuss that when we talk about people with disabilities, we also need to include home care workers because they help our folks with disabilities be able to manage and do everyday work. And so I think that is very important to make sure that the task force does include all of the types of work that home care workers have to do to help our folks with disabilities live their everyday lives and find jobs that help them find happiness and dignity and live in dignity. So I really appreciate that you brought that because I'm sure that this task force will now consider the home care workers if they weren't before. So I appreciate that perspective.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, thank you both for your support of this bill and this testimony. Yeah. Anybody else from the audience? And just a reminder, we did hear earlier, I think it's back in February, from the DHS and their work on vocational rehab. If you want to review your notes from that meeting, it would be great. And I'm closing public hearing on House Bill 2965 and closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee. And you may have the rest of the week off. Development Committee. And you may have the rest of the week off. Forced